Well, here we go. Let's talk about Jesus' birth and incarnation, shall we? In the New Testament, this is the account that we're given in Luke of Jesus' birth, how it all begins. So Luke 1, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary, and the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you are to call him Jesus." Mary said, "How is this going to happen since I am a virgin?" Now, from the moment the Gospels open, both Matthew and Luke, we have this fantastical story, a virgin woman told she's going to give birth, and from there the famous Christmas story unfolds. There's the scandal of Mary's pregnancy, Joseph's turmoil and his vision, the journey to Bethlehem, Jesus in a manger, shepherds, wise men, Herod trying to kill all the babies, their escape to Egypt. It's an incredibly strange and awesome story. But what does it all mean, particularly when most of us have probably heard it 100 times? Is there anything left in the story to give? And I want to focus on what it means, but I know that for many people, the whole idea of a virgin birth is a bit of a stumbling block. So I have a few thoughts on that, but I thought if anyone's particularly interested, I'll save that for question response time. And so if you want to chat about that, we can. But I thought I would focus this morning instead on what it all means. And I've come to think that the story of Jesus' birth, the incarnation, is actually a story that answers some particular questions about God. And so here are the 4 questions that I think Jesus' story, the birth, incarnation, here are the 4 questions I think, there's probably more, but the 4 that I think they address about God. First is this: God, do you get me? Are you relatable? Second, God, what are you like? Third, God, how do I approach you? And fourth, God, where can I find you? So I want to move through those 4 questions. And our circle, our fall circle, almost comes full stride here. If you remember a few weeks ago, I did a sermon on God, and I talked about God as hyper-being. And that when we speak of God, we are speaking about something beyond anything we could conceptualize and imagine. Anything, this God is beyond our language, beyond our understanding. And I remember in question time, Peter Thurley actually made a very interesting comment statement. He said, "You know, the God you're describing, Brad, seems very hard to relate to and very impersonal." Which I think is precisely the point. This God who is other, holy, is really hard to relate to. And this God does raise all sorts of interesting questions. And so in many ways, I think the birth story of Jesus is an attempt to respond to some difficult questions we often have about God. So let's work our way through those 4 questions. God, do you get me? Are you relatable? Have you ever asked someone a question and had them reply to your question with a question of their own? Can be incredibly exasperating. Kristen is incredibly good at the art of this, and it vexes me. It's so frustrating to me. I'll be innocently around the house asking things. Kristen, have you seen my keys? Have you seen my wallet? Do you know where the frying pan is? And I mean, all of these are reasonable questions, to be sure. And yet, without fail, I find myself sort of interrogated. I feel like I'm under a hot lamp. She comes back with these questions. Why would I have seen your keys? I don't know. Just answer the question. Have you seen the keys? Have you tried looking for your wallet? Of course I've tried looking for it. Brad, do you know what a frying pan looks like? Yes, I know what a frying pan looks like. Just answer the question. And it's interesting because in the Bible, there's a book that feels like this exact sort of thing. All it really is a series of questions back and forth. And it leaves me, this book, frustrated in the same way that I do whenever I have one of these back and forths with Kristen. Some of you might be familiar with the book of Job. It's the story of a man, aptly named Job, who is very wealthy and healthy and has a tremendous life going for him. And then everything that Job loves and enjoys in life is taken from him. And he enters this period of tremendous suffering in life. He's a farmer. All of his livestock are completely destroyed. And then in this incredibly awful accident, all of his children are in a house and a windstorm comes, blows down the house, and all of his children are killed. And then on top of that, Job becomes incredibly ill. The story goes that he's covered from head to toe in boils. It's just a nasty scene. His life suddenly goes from great to being full of suffering and incredibly miserable. And in the midst of Job's suffering and loss, what happens is Job has three friends who show up to his house and they start discussing why all of this is happening to Job. And Job's friends are convinced that Job has done something wrong. Obviously, you did something to cause all of this suffering in your life. But Job maintains his innocence. He's done nothing. His suffering is without cause. He's innocent. And there are these brilliant monologues in the book where he simply bombards God with questions and complaints. He wants God to explain why this is happening. And at the heart of Job's complaint against God, it seems, is that he finds it difficult to relate to God. God has no idea what it's like to be Job in his suffering. And so the heart of his complaint and question is, God, you're impossible to relate to. Listen to his words. This is him talking to his friends who think he's done something wrong. And he's asking for like a court battle with God. He says this, "How then can I dispute with God? How can I find words to argue with him? He's not a mere mortal like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there were someone to mediate between us, someone to bring us together, someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more. Then I would speak up without fear. But as it is now, I cannot." And then he starts speaking directly to God. He says, "Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as a mortal sees? Are your days like those of a mortal, or your years like those of a strong person?" Job has all these hard questions. God, you're so unrelatable, and all this is happening to me, and all I want is for us to sit down and talk it through. And through the majority of the book, God is completely silent. And then right at the end, God speaks. But God speaks with about 100, 200 questions. God prods Job about whether he understands what it's like to be God. And so it almost feels at the end of the book like you have like a schoolyard battle. You've got Job sort of saying, "Yeah, well, you don't understand what it's like to be me." And God's like, "Yeah, well, you don't understand what it's like to be me." And the book ends with that tension. There's this tension. It's unbreakable. It's like, ah, how do you piece this together? Both sides are essentially like, you don't know what it's like to be me. And so I think we, the readers, were left going, come on, you took the easy way out, God. You just asked a bunch of complex questions. It would be nice if you had answered Job's complaints and questions. I think Job's questions and complaints are indicative of humanity in general. I mean, I think in some ways we really, really need a God that we can relate to. Reminded of the story of a scared little girl that I think sums up humanity's need for a relatable God. And the story goes like this. One evening, a young girl tiptoed into her bedroom. She was scared because she thought there were monsters in her closet. And so her mother gently took her back to her room, explained to her there's no such thing as monsters. You don't need to be afraid. And right at the end, right as she was putting her daughter back to bed, she said, "You don't need to be afraid. God is with you." And the little girl replied, "Yeah, I know God is with me, but tonight I need someone with skin on." Oh, I love it. And I think the words of a child cut straight to the heart. Is this not what Job is asking for? I need someone with skin on. Someone who gets what I'm going through. The book of Job ends with only questions. He's sort of left wondering, why didn't you just answer? Why could you not have responded, God, to Job's questions and complaints? And what I think is just brilliant, though, is that I think God does answer the question. God does answer the complaints about a few hundred years later, mind you. But the answer is found in four words, the beginning of John chapter 1, and simply says, "The Word became flesh." And packed into those four small words, I think, is the response, the answer. God has put skin on. And that's the reason we celebrate Christmas. I think the essence of the Christmas story is found right there. The God who is so other that we can't ever reasonably hope to know or understand this God becomes one of us. I like how Eugene Peterson says it. He said, God became flesh and moved into our neighborhood. And so to the question, God, do you get me? Do you understand? Are you relatable? I think God's response seems to be, I've made the move. I put skin on so I would understand you, so that I could relate to you. And I think it reveals something absolutely fascinating about God. God, what are you like? The incarnation story in my mind does more than just put God with skin on. More than that, it reveals something about this God. And what I think it reveals is this. This God of completely beyond language and conception, unfathomable power, appears to us clothed in humility. If there's one word that sums up the incarnation, the nature of the Word becoming flesh, I think it's humility. And while this God that is so other we don't know about, the one thing I think is safe to say is that this God is humble. Kristen's grandparents, they own a couple of cottages up in Muskoka. And they're absolutely gorgeous up there. I still remember one of the first times I went up to the cottage, I was going to be introduced to her grandparents. And I was incredibly nervous because I wanted continued access to the cottage, the boats, the water skiing, all that. Wanted continued access. And so I was very nervous about meeting them. So we were having a barbecue out back, and I remember, you know, there was probably about 20 of us sort of mingling around, and we were having hot dogs, and hot dogs are always nerve-wracking for me because I tend to put on too much mustard, and it spills, it's just ugly. And I was so nervous about meeting them. And finally, we were milling about, and finally, I sort of found myself in a conversation with them with my hot dog in hand. And it seemed to be going well. So in my head, I thought, I'm going to invite us to take the next level here in a relationship. So I said, they're old, right? So why don't you have a seat? Let's have a seat. We'll continue chatting. I said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. I gave them a lawn chair for him, lawn chair for her. And then I went to sit down in my lawn chair. And as I sat down, I heard just a and poof, my lawn chair collapsed right behind me. I was folded up in the lawn chair, holding my hot dog, trying to make sure it doesn't spill. And of course, everyone starts laughing. I'm stuck on the ground trying to keep my hot dog. And the worst part is this. I'm trying, Kristen, please help me. I can't get up. And she's laughing. She can't do it. The worst part is this. Kristen's grandparents, Tim's here, they're a little grumpy. Anyway, so the grandmother says to me, I can't believe you broke our lawn chair. Like, how awful was that? I'm on the ground, and so now I'm trying to apologize, holding the hot dog, trying to get up. I was absolutely humiliated, completely humiliated. And I think it's so helpful to reflect on moments of humiliation in our life, because the relationship between humiliation and humility to me is incredibly fascinating. Because of what I've come to think is this, being humiliated is really just being forced into a state of humility. I mean, it's hard to have an ego when your lawn chair has collapsed and you're on the ground holding a hot dog. It's hard to sort of think that you're better than other people when you're in that situation. It's hard to think a lot of yourself when you have been forced into a humiliating event. And what's so profound and mysterious to me about the incarnation, the birth of Christ, the Word becoming flesh, is that God seems to willingly subject himself to the greatest of humiliations. I mean, consider the innate humility of the following statements. Think on these. The omnipotent God in one instant makes himself breakable. The God who is larger than the universe, who holds the universe, becomes a microscopic embryo. God as fetus. The one who created life is now being created. The Word of God, Jesus, of course, referred to as the very Word of God, can't speak, can only make unintelligible sounds, like every child will have to be taught how to speak. The Word of God learning to speak. The God of the entire cosmos who feeds and sustains us all is now helplessly nursing on the breast of a young Jewish girl. The one who is the very light of the world can't see without the light. And I like to think of Jesus as a child being scared of the dark, the light of the world scared and needs a nightlight. Or the God who controls and holds all things together will now not be able to even control his own bladder. God, toilet training. I mean, I don't know. For me, that God would show up in skin is amazing. That God would show up in skin in such a humble way, a vulnerable baby born into straw poverty with dung and dirty animals, is just mind-blowing to me. And God, I think, has answered the question, humanity's need for a God with skin on. But what we find as we look at this God is that this God is humble. I came across a line, and some friends and I, we like to joke about this, but in a reading, I forget what celebrity it was. In an interview, the celebrity in an interview said, one of my biggest problems is dealing with the magnitude of being me. And so whenever I'm with a certain group of friends, whenever they ask me how I'm doing, I'm like, well, it's tough because I'm dealing with the magnitude of being me. And I like to joke about that. And it's interesting to me because I think a lot of times we sort of innately sense that life is difficult. Our lives are big and complex. And if there's any being, this God being, who's actually so huge in magnitude, dealing with the magnitude of who God is, and yet this God reveals himself in a child in humility. Ah, there's something so incredibly poetic and beautiful about that. So how do we approach this humble God? When Kristen and I lived in Galt, we had a bunch of pet squirrels. I guess they weren't pets in the strictest sense of the word, but they lived in our walls, and there was like a dozen of them. They lived in our walls, and every day you could hear them scurrying, sometimes fighting in the walls. They were always up to no good, and I became quite fond of these squirrels that were living in our walls and on our fire escape. It started naming them. My cat Frank would watch them. It was funny to watch him try to charge at them, hit the glass when he did, but they were always outside and in our walls, and I became quite fond of them. I started feeding them a little bit. They were already there, so I was taking care of them. And one day I heard this terrible ruckus outside on the fire escape, just a shaking, a rattling. Went outside to check and see what was going on, and I realized that one of the squirrels had fallen down the eaves trough, and something was blocking it so it couldn't get out the bottom, and it was straight up, so it obviously couldn't get out the top. And so I'm shining a light there, looking on one of my squirrel friends, and it couldn't move. It was stuck there. I thought, ah, my squirrel, I'm going to have to rescue my squirrel. I'm like, don't worry, little buddy, I'm going to get you a stick. And so then I started looking around for a stick so that I could climb out, and it took forever to find the right length and sort of girth. And so I stuck this stick down the eaves trough, and as I'm trying to rescue it, this squirrel is freaking out. It's so terrified. It can't understand that what I'm trying to do is help. It's just, freaking out. So finally I had to leave the stick. I went into my house, watched. Finally, about half an hour later, when I was out of sight, gone, it crawled up the stick. Yay, it was a happy story for all of us. But what was so fascinating to me is these squirrels were terrified of me. And even though I appreciated them, was trying to help them, they were so scared. And I think what we realize through the scriptures is that so often this is the case between God and people. Until the incarnation, people's relationship with God was marked by fear. And interestingly enough, not a lot has changed today. For so many people today, the relationship with God is simply marked by fear. Fear. I mean, we see this throughout the Old Testament. Some of these stories are crazy. Moses was not permitted to see the face of God because he would die. If you touched the sacred mountain, you would die. If you mishandled the Ark of the Covenant, you died. In fact, there's one fascinating story where the ark's about to fall off its carrier. Some guy being nice tries to stop it, dead because he touches it. In fact, by Jesus' time, it was so taboo, people lived in such fear of God that it was taboo to even pronounce the name of God. And while it's perhaps not that extreme today, for many, I think so many people today, their relationship is simply one of fear. We see it in other religions. We see it in our own religion. People are terrified of this God. This hyper-being God is unapproachable. And so in the incarnation, you have this unapproachable God whose glory and greatness are so overwhelming, no one can even look upon this God. Suddenly, this God becomes as approachable as a newborn baby. Oh, it's fascinating. And notice how the author of Hebrews makes this point later on. I love this. Hebrews 4, it says this: "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us firmly hold to the faith we profess. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." Paul picks up the same thing in Ephesians 3. He says this: "In him," speaking of Jesus, "in him and through faith in him, we may approach God with freedom and confidence." Incarnation changes everything. There's no more need to fear this God. We can approach this God with confidence, with freedom. Finally, though, where can we find this God, the divine? I think the final mystery of the incarnation, the final question about God, is where can we find this God today? And I believe part of the mystery of the incarnation is that it reveals to us that God is found in the ordinary. The divine reveals itself looking very, very ordinary. I was with a group of friends this week, and we were sharing childhood memories of Christmas. And the stories my friends shared with me, it came as a complete revelation to me. First of all, my memories of Christmas are all positive. And I, growing up, have no bad memories of Christmas. Every Christmas day was just magical. My older two brothers still have a controversy with my parents. They claimed one Christmas morning they were spanked on Christmas Day, and they're still bitter about it. My parents, this is the interesting thing, I was talking to Todd about the nature of memories. My parents say, "That never happened. You're making that up." And my brothers are like, "No, you spanked us on Christmas." Anyway, so there's this controversy going there. But for me, all I have is positive memories of Christmas. And yet, as I listened to my friends tell their stories, what became obvious to me is that each of their stories of childhood and Christmas was marred by hurt and pain. I started to realize that maybe my experience growing up at Christmas was a bit unique, because all of my friends, their stories all had elements of hurt by family, pain by family. And, you know, it's interesting because Christmas is always advertised as such a magical time of the year, but for many it's just a season of complications, particularly around family, right? So Christmas often leaves us, you know, we're juggling full calendars, there's all these expectations, we have large doses of nostalgia, but we also have these difficult memories and family complications. And you know, in a season that gives us all of this, it's like, where do you find God in all of that? Where is the divine found when Christmas brings so many family complications? And you know, I think what the story of Jesus' birth reminds us of is that God is found in all of that. Right there in all of the ordinary family drama and pain and hurt. My friend's stories got me thinking about the actual Christmas story about Jesus' birth, and I had a revelation this week, because in terms of complications with family at Christmas, I was reminded that this was Jesus' experience as well. I mean, let me point out something about Jesus' birth story that I think we've missed. I know I've missed until recently. It was actually Herb Spencer who pointed this out to me. Some of you remember Herb Spencer. But listen to how the story unfolds in Luke 2. Then let me make an observation about it. "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world, and everyone was supposed to go to their own town, their hometown, to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them." No guest room. And for so long, I sort of pictured this as Mary and Joseph showing up at the Best Western. It's like, "Sorry, we don't have any vacancies." But there's something much more scandalous going on here, and it's this. Joseph's returning to his hometown. Some of you will do at Christmas. You'll head back to where your parents live, where you grew up. He's returning to his hometown, which means he has a lot of family there, and he probably also has a lot of friends there. And in first century hospitality, you didn't go to the Best Western. You stayed with family and you stayed with friends, particularly in your hometown. But that's the scandal of it. Nobody wants Mary and Joseph because something fishy is going on. They're not married, but she's pregnant. So whose child is she carrying? Oh, God's. Oh, sure. Yeah, no, sorry, we don't have any room for you. And so on that first Christmas, Jesus the divine is found where? Right in the middle of a family drama. Right in the middle of family pain and hurts. Right in the middle of family not getting along and people being hurt because of it. And I think what the incarnation tells us is that God is found right in the ordinary. And is there anything more ordinary than families having drama? I don't think so. There's nothing quite as ordinary as families not getting along, having difficulties, having fights, and there being leftover hurt and pain because of it. The divine is always waiting to be born right inside of that. And so one of the things I'm learning at a place like Nexus is how painful and difficult I think this season is for many people, because it brings up old wounds, things our parents did or things as kids we did to our parents. It brings up past hurts. It's a time of tension, expectations around family. And amidst all of that, the promise of the incarnation is that the God can be found even there, especially there. And I don't know exactly what that looks like in your context, but there's a good possibility many of you will be at family gatherings where there's tension between you and whoever it is. But I think for those who have eyes to see, the divine is waiting in the ordinary, even ordinary family drama. And so in the incarnation, we learn that God took on skin to get to us, to relate to us. We learn that whatever else can be said about this other God, this God is apparently humble. Humble enough that we can approach this God through Christ with confidence and freedom, not fear. And finally, the divine is found in the ordinary, especially the ordinariness of family drama. So may you, this holiday season at Christmas, when you're about to lose it on Uncle Joe, or you're having that political discussion and you're like, I can't get this person, or when all those old wounds are coming up, perhaps we would have eyes to see that maybe the divine can be found even there. So I want to do a question response time while you're thinking about maybe some questions you might have. We added an event this Christmas season that we thought would be interesting. So obviously we have Chipsmas coming up, but then on December 21st, which is winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, the darkest day of the year, we're hosting a lantern walk. So we're going to start at my place, go around, bring a mug for some soup. It's going to be delightful and cozy. And then we'll end up at my place, and I am going to build a fire in my backyard, and maybe we'll stand around and sing some carols and have some hot chocolate. But we're hoping that it'll be just a nice, neat sort of reminder to fight back against the dark on this shortest day of the year. So everyone's welcome to come along. It'll probably take about an hour. Just going to walk around the neighborhood and end up with what I hope will be a blazing fire. So I got an axe. I'm ready to chop some wood. I'm good to go.